today is November 11th. It's my mother's birthday.
Ah,
75th.
Mazel tov to her. 75. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And let's see, 2013. So I want to start with it's Sefer Chinuch, and we're going to do mitzvahs 364 to 367, hopefully. I want to start with a correction, which I misspelled already, so I'll correct the correction. I guess I didn't misspell that. I just copied that. Shloha HaKodesh is actually Isaiah Horovitz. I gave you the wrong name last time.
Oh, not me.
Somebody
Lublin.
Gave me... Right. Okay. Somebody gave... I mean, I just looked it up, and it was the wrong citation. This is the correct citation.
And the correct date,
and the correct dates, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Shnei Luchot HaBrit, he wrote that. Okay. Now we are going to start with 364. So we have... This week we're going to do Vidui, which we're all familiar with, and then we're going to do Sota, which maybe we'll learn something about. Hello.
Oh, thank you.
Lovely.
Oh, yum.
Lunch.
Okay. So this is the precept of confession of our sins, Vidui al ha-chait. We are commanded to confess before the Lord to all the sins we committed at the time we are remorseful over them. This is the substance of the confession that a person should say at the time of repentance. So here's the text, really. I pray thee, O eternal Lord, I sinned rebelliously and committed iniquity deliberately, thus and so. In other words, he should mention the sin he did explicitly in words and beseech forgiveness for it, and let him continue at length about the matter according to the eloquence of his tongue. Right? So everybody's supposed to say their own thing. But they're supposed to say it. So that's the mitzvah. So it's interesting. The mitzvah is given in connection. So here's the verse that we see it in. About this, it was stated, speak to the Israelites, when a man or woman shall commit any of the sins that men do, to commit a breach of faith against the Lord, whereupon that soul will be guilty, they shall confess their sin which they have done. And it's connected with bringing a korban, that you're supposed to bring a korban chatat for the sin offering, while it's alive, and confess over it, not after it's been slain, but while it's still alive. So you might think, so that's what I have on this piece of paper, Hava Amina, which is said quickly, and it sounds like Hava Amina. Well, it sounds like one word, but it's really Hava Amina. Hava Amina. A Hava Amina is something that you would think, that you might think, if you didn't know this. So you might think that confession is only when there's an offering. But this mitzvah is coming to tell you, no, it's actually separate from an offering. Don't think that it's connected to it. It is something that you do when you give an offering, but it's a separate and distinct mitzvah, so it's not just dependent on giving an offering. And since you might think, you might have the Hava Amina that this has to do with offerings, you might also think that, okay, you don't have to do it with an offering, but you only have to do it in Israel, in the land of Israel, where you could give an offering. But in fact, that's not the case.
Hello.
Welcome. In fact, that's not the case. You have to do it whether or not there's an offering, wherever you are. This is its own separate mitzvah and is not limited at all to whether or not there's an offering. Let's see, why do they have this marked? It would be so good if I knew.
So what does Hava Amina mean?
Something
so
you might
say. Hava Amina is what you would have thought had I not told you this.
Right.
So...
That's very... This is...
It's a specific halachic thing. I'm trying to think of a good example. You might think that on Shabbos you could carry an umbrella to keep the rain off of you, right? Except
building
for it's considered building. Sure. So your Hava Amina is incorrect. You know, you might think something works unless you're told specifically that it doesn't. So why would you think that an umbrella is like building? Right, because it doesn't seem like it's building. It seems like it's putting up a tent, maybe. I don't know, but it's enough. Turns out that the halacha rules that it's enough of a tent that it's not something you're permitted to do on Shabbat. So you might think, you might know that you can't carry umbrellas. So you might have a Hava Amina that the reason why you can't carry an umbrella on Shabbos is because of carrying. So that if there's an Eruv, you could. Right? That could be your Hava Amina.
Right.
But in fact,
it's like building, and so the Eruv doesn't
so
do
that's
anything.
Why you can't do it, right?
If it's gonna rain,
this is just explaining Hava Amina. But the truth
things
is,
over the black hat.
That's correct. Yeah, busting over the black hat. Now they have these great raincoats they sell in the deli. These crazy firm raincoats and have huge hoods. So the hood is designed to go over your black hat, right? Or if you're female, to go over your sheitel and leave enough room so you don't muss your hair in the rain. But that's the idea. So you can wear one of those, but you can't take an umbrella on Shabbat. So just so you know.
But it hardly ever rains here, so we're okay.
Right, right. It's not Oregon. I just came back from Oregon. It's like, oh, I forgot. It's like right here all the time.
It does.
I don't know how people have any energy for anything. It was like 10:30 in the morning. I felt like it was 7 a.m. Like looking outside, I was like, should I wake up yet or not? It just wasn't any sun. And then when somebody came in and said, oh, it's so sunny and nice out, I'm like,
really?
Oh, I guess the clouds are white instead of gray. I guess that's their definition of sunny. Yeah, it's very different. Okay, so basically this is just where did we go here? I lost my place. Okay. This is the mitzvah of vidui, which we know is part of the mitzvah of tshuva. This is actually the mitzvah of tshuva, that you have to do this, I'm pretty sure. But the actual mitzvah is confession, that the mitzvah of tshuva is done through the act of confession. So it's not enough to have remorse in your heart, you actually have to say it out loud to God, not to anybody else, but to God. It has to be a conversation between you and God.
The thing here that it's at the time we are remorseful, which hopefully isn't the time you commit the sin.
Well, you're not always remorseful when you commit the sin.
So it's at the time that you feel remorse. Don't even realize it.
Well, sometimes you don't realize it, and sometimes you're not remorseful. You know, sometimes you don't care that you ate that thing. You know, whatever it was. Or you're at a time in your life when you really don't care. You don't care. So a kid who's texting on Shabbos, you know, they don't feel bad about that at all. Right? But then a few years later, they realize, oh, gosh, I really shouldn't have done that. You know, I feel bad that I did it, and I knew better than, you know, I shouldn't have done it. And now they feel remorseful, and now is the time to confess. You're not going to say it right in that moment. Hopefully, you know, those of us who, you know, sometimes you do things by mistake. Like you go into the bathroom and you come out and you just flick the light off on Shabbos. You're like, oh, it's Shabbos. So these things happen, and then you would want to say right then, you know,
I'm sorry. Has to pee in the dark.
Right. Right. So, right. So you're sorry that you did that, and you can say that right away because you are remorseful right away. But sometimes we do things and we're not remorseful right away. So it's in the time of remorse, whatever that is, whether it's immediate or delayed. And that it has to be out loud, and that it has to be with words, and that we say it to God, and that is actually, and this is actually a very important thing, this is actually the essence of the mitzvah of tshuva. The offering is also important, but this is a sticking point actually between Judaism and Christianity. Right? The offering is not the key thing, and the offering actually doesn't work. A sin offering is ineffective without remorse and confession. So with the offering, there has to be remorse and confession. But without remorse and confession and with an offering, atonement is not achieved.
Unless you confess.
That's what you're saying.
With an offering, without remorse and confession, atonement is not achieved.
Right.
Without an offering,
buy your way out.
You cannot buy your way. No, you cannot buy your way out. Right. Without an offering, with remorse and confession, atonement is achieved.
Right.
So that's one of those questions. Did God know the temple was going to be destroyed?
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. That's not a question. Yeah.
And set this up so that we could have tshuva.
No, so he set up tshuva before he set up mitzvahs. Right. The concept of tshuva. It's interesting because it talks about, if you read the book, The Waters of Eden by Aryeh Kaplan, which is a book on mikvah, a small book on mikvah. It's interesting. A lot of little pamphlets that he wrote in the 70s, they're written for NCSY. They're written for teenagers, but today they're for adults. I mean, just our brains are so different than the teenage brain at the time. It's amazing to think about it. Anyway, that book is written for NCSY in the 70s about mikvah, and it's a great book, has lots of interesting stuff in it. But one of the things it discusses is that in the narrative of creating Adam and Eve and putting them in the garden, so the garden is made, they're made, then there's an interruption in the narrative that a river runs forth from Eden and explains the four rivers and the parameters of it, and then they're given the mitzvah not to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and bad. It's very important to finish that sentence, by the way, knowledge of good and bad, not just knowledge, because people say it's the tree of knowledge, people think, well, God didn't want us to know anything. Like, what kind of God is that? So it's not. It's a different thing. And it's really das. It's the Eitz HaDas, Tovah Ra. the knowledge of good and bad. It's really the connection of good and bad. It's a whole different thing when you understand what it is and its root of the connection between good and bad and where, if that's inside of us or if that's outside of us. Anyway, so the mitzvah was only given after the waters were put in place, and the waters or mikvah waters put in place first.
So that you could.
So that there's a pathway to repentance before there's a pathway to transgressing God's will. So before God tells us what he wants of us, he sets up a way for us to fix the problem of us not doing what he said. So he absolutely knew from the start that we're human beings, he's going to tell us what to do, and we're going to not. But there's times when we will, and there's times when we won't. So he set up the world with a way to repair the damage before he set up a possibility of damage occurring. So that's important to know. But it's also very important to know, just as a principal distinction, between one of the principal distinctions between Judaism and Christianity. I heard somebody this week saying that the two religions face each other back to back, that they are walking in different directions. Like somehow there's a connection, but they face each other back to back. And if you go with one, it negates the other.
You can't do both.
You cannot.
Nothing with the Jews
there
for Jesus
nothing.
And all
yeah.
that.
No, it's forget like, Jews for Jesus. Right? There is no way that you can do both. So this Shabbos, I spoke about the Judeo-Christian roots of the United States, and there are Judeo-Christian roots, and what does that mean, and how do you put them together at all? But there are some roots that are really
common.
That are common in the Torah, in the
way
five
back.
Books. Yeah, way back.
Not now so much.
Well, so the Christians, to the extent... So the Judeo-Christian roots of the United States of America include biblical things that the Christians brought here.
Okay.
Right? So it's okay. Judeo... through Christians manifested in America. Because Judeo-Christian doesn't mean Jews came here and started up Jewish ideas. It means Christians came here
and had some
Jewish ideas because they were busy at the time becoming literate and engaging in Bible reading and understanding that there's a way delineated in the Old Testament, what they would call the Old Testament in the Torah, of how to set up a society, and they want to try that experiment here. So they brought Jewish ideas, Torah ideas, to this country.
Through a Christian filter.
Yeah, it was through a Christian filter, and it was a Christian enterprise. Because they saw themselves, it was a replacement theology, they saw themselves as the new Jews. But the Jews got the Torah, they dropped the ball, and now the Christians were holding it, and now since the Christians held the Bible, they want to set up a society based on that Bible. And they couldn't because it was a political threat to the powers that were at the time in England. Right?
And the church.
And the church, right? Church and state were mixed.
Mixed, right.
So they came here to start fresh on an empty
slate.
Canvas. Yeah. And, you know, in an empty country with nobody here.
So to speak.
Right.
Didn't they want, the founding fathers wanted the official language of this country to be Hebrew?
Yeah, that was definitely a question. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that was definitely a question. So they were looking at how will they use this document, this five books, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Hebrew, because the literate man at the time, of course, only men were literate, but the literate man at the time knew Hebrew and Greek and Latin and the language that he spoke, because those languages made him literate in the Bible. Right, in his version of the Bible, right, plus the language that he spoke. So there was really a question because they saw that the New Testament doesn't really have anything to do with setting up a society, but the Old Testament, the Torah, does. So they wanted to be literate in Hebrew and set up a society based on...
Modeled on that.
Yeah, modeled on what God asked of people to do in a society. So why not then use the language that God gave that legal document to humanity through... which was Hebrew. And so Hebrew was taught in the early colleges. It was required.
It's on the seal of Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And another thing I was going to say, I'm reading a book on the Crusades, and the whole concept that the Catholic Church was based on were these papal bulls where you could essentially pretend like you're sacrificing a bull. That's why they call it a bull. It really wasn't
really
a bull.
Really? I didn't know that's what they
I just read
that,
which is interesting. I didn't realize it. But basically, you kind of bought your confession. You know,
yes.
Even by going on the crusade,
you bought their
absolution
salvation
of your sins for the next 50
stuff,
years.
Yeah.
And it was basically just exchanging money. That
straight
was
up.
It. There was no remorse. There was no,
no.
confession of guilt. It was just straight money.
Right, yeah, straight up. So apparently there's a cathedral, I think, in France that has a tower in it called the Butter Tower. because one of the things that you couldn't have during Lent was animal products, so dairy, mm-hmm. butter. Imagine a French person going for 40 days without butter.
Really? So they just had to do a thing and they could have it. And
then they got it. You could have butter.
Free, right. Butter-free croissant.
Right, so if they would pay to the church, they could have butter.
They just got it.
Right, so that tower was built on butter money.
Yeah.
I feel like this was like my aha moment, because I remember as a child getting in a very large argument with my mother in church. And I said to her, I go, I am not going into that confessional. I am not telling that priest what I did wrong, because Hashem saw it. Well, I didn't say Hashem at the time. I was like, he saw what I did wrong. I don't need to tell that priest. I'm not doing it.
Right.
And I got in a whole bunch of trouble. It was horrible. But I think if I look back now, that must have been my aha moment when I realized... Uh-huh.
It's not between you and the priest. It's between you and God.
Wow. Yeah. So you're a convert from Catholicism?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, very stringent Catholicism.
Wow, amazing. Mm-hmm.
Like, beat you with a belt Catholicism. Yes.
Uh-huh. You probably have beautiful handwriting.
All those nuns.
Right.
Oh,
cool.
Yep. Those who go to Catholic school you can tell by their handwriting what they must
clearly
have suffered.
I failed that one.
Those of us who never learned to run.
Yesterday was we had a birthday celebration for my mother in Oregon, so everybody, it was a whole big circle. It took 3 hours, so everybody went around, said things they appreciated, what they learned from her, blah, 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 blah. So I was the last one, so I couldn't really say a long thing. Because
everybody else,
it was really like, no, I had about to say, but I said something I didn't learn from her. So something I didn't learn from her was how to lay guilt trips, which I appreciated in her parenting, but as a Jewish mother, I totally needed. So,
cool.
So I explained how I used it correctly in order to elicit letters of appreciation from all the children, because I sent an email asking all the kids to send letters that I could give her, and Gitti was the first one who wrote, and for a few days, nobody else. So I correctly used her letter with permission from her to send to everybody else and say, Gitti wrote a letter.
Okay, guys.
And the rest of you are asleep at
the and the rest forked it over. Anyway, so, so this should be an aha moment, and that's why I want to point this out, because whether it's J for J or whether it's other Christians, they really do feel like their Lord and Savior was the final sacrifice for the atonement of all future sins. So
you don't have to do it.
We no longer need to do that,
okay.
Thinking that sacrifice is enough. And in fact, it's important to know our theology is that sacrifice is not it at all. That's only an extra,
it's an
when the temple's there. It's nice if you can. And if you can't, you can completely achieve it with remorse and confession. Whereas without remorse and confession, even with a sacrifice, forget about it, as they say in Brooklyn. So the Christian plan doesn't work, according to Torah ideals.
Yeah. So, you know, why don't Christians just run amok? I mean,
yes.
I mean, you know... I'm not going to get punished anymore.
No accountability.
Right.
So
I guess they are human beings and they have some sense of that.
Well, it depends on the stream. So, there's all kinds of different streams in Christianity.
Right.
One of them, which I believe is Calvinist, which must have an effect, even though I don't think anybody actually believes it quite this way. But there is a stream that you're born damned or saved. How can you tell? Because your works don't make a difference. What you do doesn't make a difference because... You know, he did die for your sins, so you either are saved or not saved. So the only way you can tell who's saved or who's not saved, who's walking on the planet, is the ones who behave nicely.
Oh.
That's how you could tell that they're saved.
Uh-huh.
So.
And they may not be, but...
No, that's how you could tell they are.
Right.
So that's the obvious difference, is the saved person is a mensch.
So
then you'd want to be a mensch because you'd want to
be
one
sure
of the saved.
Saved, yeah.
So I think there may be some of that. I think there's other things too. I mean, you know, certainly I did not go into services yesterday, but I did go for the Kiddush after services because there was a retirement, because my mother retired also from her church as a para clergy person. So, but there is a whole big thing about reflecting the light of...
Kiddush afterwards.
Yeah. That's how I had to see it, even though I couldn't eat at it. The whole thing was so uncomfortable, I can't even tell you. Here I am, this Rebbetzin, I come in from out of town, I do a Shabbaton at the shul, and Motzei Shabbos I did a whole Rebbetzin in-service thing, and then the next day I go to church. Like, really? How is this my life?
You do it very well.
Such a stretch. It's such a stretch.
Where were you when you were 12 years old?
So, but anyway, somehow they do have a concept of responsibility and responsibility to God to be his emissary as well. Mm-hmm. And they have a concept of spreading the good news. So there is a concept of, in a way, I mean, depending on the stream, there's a replacement theology. They're the new Jews, so they have to be the ambassadors of the Lord on the earth. So there are some who believe that.
I think they lack that level of responsibility. I mean, I sat next to a woman yesterday, and she told me that she has 7 children, and I said, I'm very curious how, you know, what the plan is to put 7 children through college. I was very curious because I've been thinking about that recently. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, the Lord will provide.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Okay. The Lord will. They'll get scholarships, they'll take loans, they'll figure it out, you know.
Or they won't go to college.
Or they won't go to college, yeah.
I don't know, that wasn't an acceptable answer to me. No, I'm like, that's lack of responsibility, you know?
Well, I don't think putting through college is a lack of responsibility. I think feeding them is a lack of responsibility. I mean, it depends. I'm sure there's a lot. Everybody has their line.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, you don't know what's going to happen in 20 years from when you give birth, if you're going to have money for college or not. But you shouldn't be giving birth if you don't have if you can't feed them.
Wherewithal to support them.
Well, yeah, if you can't feed them. You do need to educate. And the Talmud requires educating somebody towards a parnassa. That's towards a livelihood. Mm-hmm. That's a requirement of parenting. Teach a kid how to swim, get them married, and teach them how to make a living. Mm-hmm. So today, you could say college is required for that. However, there's plenty of people who didn't go to college and make plenty nice livings.
Right. And vice versa.
And vice versa.
College,
plenty of people, right. Plenty of people today who go to college and can't. Yeah, that's what they say.
It's a common expression, from pretty much everything. Yeah. For everything, it's like this not, you know, taking responsibility for a lot of things, like accepting, I guess, the yoke.
Right. So it's interesting. I mean, there's that whole joke about the, you know, son-in-law is getting married to the girl, and the, you know, father-in-law is interviewing him and saying, "And so, how are you going to provide for, you know, the, what's your plans for, you know, for us?" He says, "Oh, the Lord will provide." He says, "And what about putting them through school?" I says, "The Lord will provide." And, you know, and tuitions for day school, and the Lord will provide. And, you know, and holiday expenses, the Lord will provide. And then they get married, and they say, "Oh, how do you like your new son-in-law?" He says, "He's great. He thinks I'm God."
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like, do you guys feel like you have enough here on confession? Okay, so let's move to 365. The precept of Sota, we're going to 365, 366, and 367 together, because they are all about Sota. So Sota means turn astray. The Sota specifically, that's what the word means, but when we say Sota, what we're talking about is a woman suspected of adultery. So she's not suspected just because the husband's jealous, but there is a whole procedure that makes her officially suspected. So that procedure is, he is jealous of her. He sees her laughing and chatting, whatever, with another man, and he says to her specifically, "I don't want to see you anywhere near Bob Smith. You know, don't go near him again." And he says that in the presence of 2 witnesses. So he makes it official and formal. Stay away from Bob Smith. Then, later, 2 witnesses see her and Bob Smith go into seclusion long enough that they could have sex. So they see them close and lock a door, and they're alone in a room for, here's the length of time, as long as it takes to, I think, boil an egg and eat it. Whatever that's cooking.
Okay.
10 minutes
to boil it.
Yeah, 10, 15
minutes. 10 minutes to peel it sometimes.
Right, yeah, depending on how old it's true. So that's what it is. So however long that is, I'm sure there's a specific time. That's the time that's set. So whatever it is, 18 minutes, something like that, you have to be alone for that long. So if they see that, they didn't see what happened. They just saw her go alone after she's been warned with that specific person. Then she's considered... Right. Roast one. That might take longer than boiling it, right? So so then she's called a Sota. That's her title. And then there's a whole ceremony for her. And this is a mitzvah that you have to do that ceremony. You don't have to warn her in front of 2 witnesses in the first place. But once you did, and then she is witnessed going into seclusion, then this process is in place, and it's a mitzvah to continue it. So that's this mitzvah. So the process is, you bring her to the Kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash. She's sat down by the in the center. Her hair is uncovered, which is embarrassing to her. And there is a korban also that's brought, an offering that's brought, which is a, which we'll see in the next one, of barley. And bitter waters are made for her to drink. So the name of God is written on a parchment, and then that name is thrown into the waters along with some dirt, and it's mixed around, and she drinks it. If she's innocent, nothing happens. If she's guilty, she and the person that she was guilty with, wherever he is on the planet, both their stomachs explode and they die.
But she's the only one who drinks it.
She's the only one who drinks it. This is the only mitzvah to which a miracle is attached. The miracle is that the stomach exploding. The magic waters. The waters work by miracle. So if she drinks it, the waters can tell. God can tell. And then either makes her and the one who didn't touch the waters, because you could say, oh, whatever, they put poison in the water. Of course she dies. What about the guy who had sex with her? No, he's far away. Who didn't drink it and is connected just through the Avera, through the transgression that they did together.
His stomach explodes.
They both die.
It doesn't say that in the Torah, that he also...
Not sure if it says that in the Torah or not, but that is the, but that's the miracle that happens. So that's what she does. If she's innocent, if nothing happens to her, then she's blessed, and she'll conceive and bear a son within the year. They can go back to her husband and they can relax and resume their relationship. So, do you have a question before I continue?
Well, I always want to try to take the side of the female, what I sometimes victim. What happens if Bob Smith pulls her into the room and rapes her?
Oh, rape is different. Yeah. Okay. That's not adultery.
This is a consensual thing.
But if we're going on hearsay of these two people that
no,
said...
No, no. So those two people, if those two people see her screaming, being dragged into the room, then they should go help her.
Well... But sometimes victims aren't, like, screaming and being drugged. Sometimes they go quietly because they're so frightened. I mean, I don't know.
No, sorry. No. That, okay. And she would not be let off the hook for that. Okay. There is a lot of discussion over who is considered adulterous or not. Let's say she says, I didn't know you're not allowed to have sex with other men now that I'm married. I had no clue. That's still considered adultery. Because that was just... you should know at least that something...
Well,
there should
also
be something.
Your husband has warned you.
Mm-hmm.
He has warned you.
Yes,
he has to have said,
yes,
maybe you didn't know this
right.
In front of my two friends
right,
here.
Right.
But
let's say she was young.
Adulterous men?
Yes.
Nothing doesn't matter.
Yeah, it does. It does. Well, so a man...
I warn my husband.
No. That, no.
Doesn't work.
Nope, it doesn't. Because that's not considered adultery.
Right. Only if the woman
That's
is.
Adultery in American and maybe adultery in Christian, but it's not adultery in Jewish. Adultery in Jewish is a man who's not the woman's husband having sex with a married woman. A man having sex with a married woman who's not married to him.
Right.
Is adultery. A man having sex with any other woman apart from his wife who's not married to somebody else is not adulterous. So that's
it's a definitional thing.
Yeah, it is. That's not adultery. That might be adultery in America.
But if she is married...
Well, if she's married to somebody else, that's adulterous. Then they're both adulterous there. So a man can commit adultery by having sex with a woman, with the wife of somebody else.
And what is the punishment for his sin?
I don't think so.
It's the same punishment spiritually. They're both
But he just doesn't have the punishment.
But he doesn't have to sit in the front of the community with his head uncovered.
Well, he's going
to
blow up if she did that. If she has to do that.
Yeah,
if,
remember.
Now.
Because he would suffer the same shit.
Wait a second, though. Let's say an adulterous man suspects his wife. And warns
her. So he
her,
was already adulterous.
He was already adulterous with somebody else.
Right.
Actually, technically adulterous. Right. And now he suspects his wife. And his wife goes through the whole process. And whether or not she is adulterous, but even let's say she was adulterous, just to show how this
make
works.
It the worst.
right? And she sits down and drinks the water. It's not going to work.
Because her husband.
Because of his sin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that miracle.
So she gets off then. She gets off.
She gets off the hook. Yes. Yeah.
Feeling a little better now.
Right. I'll tell you also, however, though, that this stopped working when we, as a nation, became less chaste. So it was during.
So it doesn't work anymore.
Everybody would have been blown
right.
up.
Well, it's when the temple everybody. Existed,
yeah.
right?
No, it was during the temples. When, during the temple existing,
so it, quit
it stopped working altogether, and they stopped keeping this because there were too many people that this would have worked for, and it wasn't. The point of this mitzvah is to clear up doubt in a couple. Right, so if a husband is suspicious, and then he does worry about his wife, and even if people will say, you know, I never ever saw her. Since you warned her, I never saw her go with him. But he still doesn't know, really. You know, and even if he would have two bodyguards follow her all the time and testify, we know for sure she was never with. Still, in the back of his mind, he might be wondering, I just don't know. But if she ends up going through this process, then it's God himself coming to say, your wife is clean. It's fine. You guys can be together and totally relax. It's a miracle meant for Shalom Bayit. It's a miracle meant to give her back her past.
How does this work, though? Because one of, you know, the Ten Commandments is basically that you won't commit, you won't covet another man's wife, so that would cause the man to commit basically a sin.
Correct.
So how does that fit into this then? Because you're saying he doesn't commit a sin.
No, I didn't say he didn't commit a sin.
I guess I'm misunderstanding them.
She just said it wasn't adultery.
Just wasn't adultery.
No. If you covet another man's wife, that's adultery.
Okay.
It's the coveting of a wife that's
yeah, the wife. Somebody
not
else
coveting
wife.
A woman.
Right.
Okay. Even if it's
so
in
the
your
Ten
heart.
Commandments.
It's not, yeah. No, it's not coveting. It's
no,
not.
I think in Judaism you have to do it.
To make it a sin. No, coveting is a problem, but its own problem. But having, yeah, you're not, it's not adulterous until you have
it.
Sex.
Okay.
And it's not right. adulterous right. if it's a single woman.
Right. So it's not coveting if all she's right. single.
Okay. All right.
Because that's not
just
your neighbor's
lusting.
Wife.
Right, you're allowed to lust after
she
somebody.
Can lust.
And you can have multiple wives. We don't condone it. We don't think it's a good idea. And it's not.
Well, now you can't do it, right?
Now you can't. Well,
you
still
could.
in some Muslim countries, Jews still do.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's not forbidden for all Jews. It's
only
forbidden for all
Ashkenazic
Jews and all Israeli Jews, which includes the bulk of the Sephardim. But it's not forbidden in Sephardic lands.
Oh,
so there may still be an Iraqi Jew who could marry a second wife, and it's okay. Halachically, it's okay. We generally don't do it, and it's not recommended. Nevertheless, it's not illegal. So for a married man to look at a single woman and say, I would like to have sex with her, and so therefore I'll marry her, hopefully, right? That's fine. He's permitted to do that. It's not adulterous. He can take a second wife. So it's not coveting. Coveting is somebody else's thing, right? Somebody else's wife, somebody else's property. I'm not saying that a wife is property, but somebody, you could covet their snowblower, you could covet their car, you could covet their wife. You can't covet, you're not allowed to desire something that belongs to somebody else, right? But something that doesn't belong to somebody else, you are allowed to desire. You're allowed to walk into Sears and say, I would like that snowblower. That's not a problem. You could buy it. So it could belong to you. So you're allowed to walk down the street and see a beautiful
single girl. If you think about the way women were perceived and viewed and all that, it really makes perfect sense.
You mean
the way women were at that time.
Well, you're saying in terms of property. So there's still, my husband teases me because there still is the concept of buying. It's not really buying, it's acquiring, with the ring.
Right.
But who are you purchased from with that?
Well, isn't it the father?
No. You don't belong to your father.
Oh.
You're purchased from you. He doesn't get the ring. You get the ring.
If he were purchased from your father,
he'd
get
the
Sears
ring.
Would
get
the money.
Right.
He's purchasing his wife.
He's purchasing his wife from his wife. He purchases
so you
from
willingly
you.
Agree to become
yes.
the property.
Yes. Haray at mekudesh et libet tabat zu. You are consecrated unto me through this ring, and you take the ring. When you take the ring, the contract has been made that through this ring, I thee wed. Right? And so you now, when you take it, you agree, I am now yours.
So it's not like
so you're bought from given. You, right? You're, so you're not
possession of
you're not purchased. You're not owned. But you're acquired in a sense from yourself to your husband. So it's not that he owns you. He doesn't. But you
except
now are now you cannot be in a relationship with anybody else.
Right.
You're consecrated to him and him alone through your ring. So that's my husband teases me all the time that the purchase price was low, but the maintenance. So anyway, but you're bought from you because you own you. And so nobody else owns you. There are other deals have been made, but it's not to purchase. So we don't actually believe in that.
But there was a time when one went to the bride's father to make a deal for her.
Right, but it's
the
still
bride
not a
price.
Purchase. Yeah. Still, it's not a purchase.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I think there are some cultural things, certainly, and there's cultural things today, too.
Sure.
I mean, you might say, what's with the candlesticks and the cufflinks and the shas and the, you know, all those exchanges? What is that? It's not legal. It's not a requirement. You don't have to have a diamond bracelet for the engagement, but a girl would feel really shafted without that diamond bracelet for her engagement today. That's what they get, right? So, that's just the reality of it. So, but that's not the law.
Neither
I never got a diamond bracelet.
I know. That's what I'm hoping that for my 30th in 2 years, maybe I'll get a collar bracelet.
I was
going to
say, I never got a diamond bracelet.
It used to be a gold bracelet back in yellow gold days. And then yellow gold went out of style. And white gold came into style, which looks like silver. Unless it has diamonds in it. And then you can tell it's gold.
I see.
That's how it happens.
What about the diamond ring? What about that?
After. See, rings have to be fitted to your finger.
Oh, you can't do that.
But the bracelet fits no matter what. So you propose with the bracelet.
Besides, this is all of us.
And Avi needs the business.
Jacob gave
I should have taken this class years ago.
Yeah, you should.
Didn't Jacob give Rivka a bracelet?
Yeah, all kinds of jewelry and stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she did. Get
good.
Them all
good. Yes, you're calling Marlon.
Yeah.
She's good on the jewelry.
Right,
department.
But she got the jewelry, not her husband,
not
her father.
Right, no, she got the jewelry.
That's right.
There's a point where it says that he, through Elijah or Elisha, gave Elijah, gave her.
It was Eliezer.
Eliezer brought the bracelets,
right.
Which then Jacob gave to Rivka.
Yaakov
I thought he gave it to her on
Yaakov
behalf
had
of.
Nothing to give.
Oh, maybe you're right. Maybe
that was for Yitzhak. Right.
Yeah.
That's for Yitzhak.
Yeah. He did
right.
give the bracelets.
Yeah, he gave it to her, but as an emissary.
It was all stolen by Levi.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So there, we don't sell.
Like every year we read this, and every year we forget it.
Right.
How do these things evolve?
That's why we have to read it every year.
How do these things evolve?
How do you get from a ring to a bracelet?
How do you get to a ring?
Well, I don't know. It must be something
right.
somewhere.
No, there's nothing for engagement rings.
There's nothing for engagement rings.
No, there's
all these things.
No, there is. So the question is, how does one wed halachically? Right, so by the exchange of something monetary that has to be worth at least a pruta, so that's a penny. You can get married with a penny, okay? So because you just have to exchange something that has some value, or with writing a contract, or with sexual consummation, ketzav shtar bia. I think there's one more.
So any one of those.
Any one of those will do the trick. We do all of them. So we exchange something that has a value. Right, so we just use a ring for that.
And a ketubah.
But it doesn't have to be. And then we have a contract. So that's a ketubah. And then you're also supposed to have kavana when you consummate that night.
So common law marriage with the intent of being married in and of itself would suffice.
All you have to do, it doesn't have to be in common law marriage. All you have to do
I'm saying with the intent.
All you have to do is
the intent.
Is have sex with the intent that this marries us and you're married, according to halacha. Right.
That's what happened to Dina. Right?
No.
She was raped, and then they said that now she needed to marry Shem.
But she didn't have the intent.
She didn't have the intent. That
but
wasn't
they,
an
but
agreed
they ultimately,
contract.
They did. They were married, right?
No. No, no divorce was required there. Meaning, because of that rape, she wasn't married to him.
Hmm.
So then,
but you said it could be a sexual thing that.
But you have to.
You
intent.
Have to both agree.
You have
can't
to both
just grab a woman, rape her, and she's
say,
your wife.
Right. You have to have both have intent,
right.
Or vice versa.
Right. Yeah, you have to both have intent that this act will marry us and want that. Mm. Right? So if somebody just doesn't, if it's one-sided, it doesn't work. Yeah. There is such a thing as if a woman is raped, if a virgin is raped, he is obligated to marry her if she wants it. She's not obligated to marry him. He's obligated to marry her. Mm. So she gets to pick if she wants to let him off the hook or not. Because she might feel like, now that I'm defiled, I'm embarrassed to face the world. I'd rather just I can't imagine the circumstances, but I guess somehow there could be a circumstance mm-hmm. where she would, and then he's obligated and he can never divorce her. Mm. He's stuck for life no matter what because he did that.
This is interesting going back to the mitzvah. It says here that a woman is never compelled to drink of the bitter water. In other words, it says here, if she says, I was defiled, or I was not defiled, yet I will not drink of it, but she can choose to get divorced instead.
Yes. She's never compelled to drink of it. Right. If she says, I was defiled. So if she admits right away, I did it, and I'm not going to drink it, or she says her innocence, but she refuses to take the test, then, yeah, she can get divorced without the payment of the ketubah. She never allowed to
So she
to
was never
her
forced. She was never really forced to drink it, only if she wanted to stay married.
Right. Right. So you can see from that, I'm glad you brought that up, thank you, you can see from that this really isn't about testing the woman. It's about restoring shalom in the couple. Because she could leave.
Without ever drinking it or confessing.
She could get married again.
Yeah, because she gets a divorce. She gets a divorce.
Yeah, she gets a divorce.
She's granted a get. And
she's granted a get, and she's free. She doesn't get the ketubah, which means she's granted a get with no money.
Does he have to give the get?
Yes.
Yes.
Has to.
Has to, yes.
He has to.
Yeah, that's what the divorce is. She's not divorced without the get.
Right.
You might
want the divorce.
No.
I'm not going to give you the get.
No, because it says in here specifically that...
No.
Right, that's what I was...
Agunas are about the failure of our society to work properly.
Right.
This
was during the temple.
This is when it worked well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, at that time, if a guy didn't want to give the get, we did have means for obtaining it from him. We did do a little roughing up without having to pay $60,000 for that. That's extortion. But, because that happened recently. But that is our way. We do, the concept is that deep down everybody wants to do what's right. It's just we cover ourselves up with all kinds of shtick. So if you knock somebody around a little bit, you'll knock some of that shtick off, and you'll get to the deep down where he wants to do what's right and actually give her the get. So that's the concept. And you are allowed to beat the guy up until he says, I want to give it to her. You can't force him, because you can't give a forced get. A forced get is ineffective. But he has to say he wants it. But you could beat him up until he says, I want it.
torture.
You're not supposed to torture them.
You just beat them up.
Right? So, I think what happened
recently... It's a fine line there.
It is a fine line, and I don't know exactly where that line is. I do know that it was crossed recently. I don't know if anybody heard the news, but that was definitely crossed. But we do have that concept, because we do have a concept of being able to enforce gets. It's not supposed to be that there's a goodness, right? So, and there's other things you get to before you beat him up. You can ostracize him from the community. People cannot sell him anything. He can't go to the local makolot. He can't go into shul to daven. He can't chat with a friend. People will cross the street and
not talk
to him.
But for some people that refuse to do it, they don't care about any of that stuff.
That's correct. But imagine living in a shtetl, really a small one.
Right.
There's no place to go.
There's no place to hide, right?
There is no place to hide.
You can't afford to move.
You can't afford to move, and that's where you do your shopping, and these are the people that you know. That's a pretty strong thing to ostracize somebody. So that was pretty effective.
It was pretty effective.
It's not that there were never agunas ever. There were. There were people who could just take off. And particularly if somebody didn't. A sailor was supposed to give his wife a get
before he left.
And then he could put it away when he came back in case his boat sank and then nobody saw it. So she's released, right? Mm-hmm. So there would be a sailor who forgot or she lost the get or whatever it is. There would be agunas. But it was rare for somebody to be as nasty as people are today in withholding gets or using them as extortion to, yeah.
thousands and
thousands. So don't the Israeli officer or the soldiers now automatically give their wives guests before they go into battle, or is that a policy?
And that was in the olden days. I don't think that's today because we have a lot of witnesses. Mm. I don't think everybody does that today. Okay. I'm not.
Yeah, nowadays it would be pretty difficult not to have witnesses.
Yeah, but it did. It was the case that people went, and that's why we have the whole Bathsheba and David thing. Is because she was given a get by her husband who was at the front.
Right.
So was she actually divorced or not?
Yeah.
Right. So that is really a question, mm-hmm. Because that was, you're right, that is what was done. Because maybe you would die and people wouldn't know.
We took our class on Shmuel.
Right. Anyway, so that's what's happening here, is that she is having her past restored to her. Her honor is being restored. What she did is being restored. So this really is a miraculous mitzvah. Again, the only mitzvah, the miracle attached. And it didn't last long, unfortunately, because it's based on, in a sense, that the chastity of the Jewish people, so that it should be an aberration, so that everybody would also see and learn from this. It was meant to be, and the person was meant to be an exemplar. Also, look, God knows. God can tell.
So
all you have to do is take the drink, and God knows, and everybody else is going to know too. You just take the drink, and it's quite obvious. There's no faking this. So, and nobody can get your back, because God knows and God sees, and it's going to work. So, but in addition to this, one thing that I want to point out is that you're actually allowed to transgress a negative mitzvah, one of the 613 negatives, in order to accomplish this, which is erasing the name of God.
Because it dissolves in the water.
Right. So you're not permitted to do that. So let me see if I have that. Yeah, so that's that right here. Yeah.
If you agree to doing it, you've agreed to.
I'm going to look back here. Right.
To an avera, in a sense, but it's one of those oxymorons.
Right.
It's like a double
exactly.
Wait a minute, I'm not following this.
But it's Mitzvah 437, that we should not demolish or eradicate those entities which the name of the Holy One, blessed be He, is linked, to which the name of the Holy One, blessed is He, is linked. For instance, the sanctuary, sacred Torah scrolls and volumes, and His precious name, blessed is He. So you're not allowed to destroy that.
Okay, now why
about all this?
This
is stated, you shall not do
you
so
put the paper with the
to the
God's
Lord your
name
God.
Into the water and
oh,
it dissolves.
Oh, I see.
So we'll get to this mitzvah later on and all that. But in order to do this mitzvah of the sota procedure, you have to transgress that mitzvah.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's an important thing to understand, because this does teach us a principle, which is that God is willing to have His name desecrated for the sake of Shalom Bayit. How important peace in the family is. Peace between husband and wife is so important that God will allow His name to be dissolved in the water to achieve that peace. So there's a story with, I'm pretty sure it's David HaMelech. So David HaMelech is digging the foundation for the Beis HaMikdash, and he strikes something. Right. Imagine a plumber who strikes a pipe and it starts to flow. Right. So it's not a pipe, obviously, because David HaMelech digging for the Beis HaMikdash. However, he does strike whatever spring or something that is underneath the Beis HaMikdash. Now, they have a whole water system underneath there in order to... It was a miraculous... So it's not a miracle attached to a mitzvah, but it was a miraculous thing that the water came up and cleaned out the whole Beit HaMikdash. If you think about it, all those animal sacrifices, all that blood... all that sprinkling, the place could reek, right? And it's not refrigerated. I went to a schlachthaus, a slaughterhouse.
Oh, it's terrible.
And even though it was spotlessly clean, spotless. I mean, everything was steel, and everything was washed down every day, and
still,
it was refrigerated and cold, and it stunk so bad. It was really hard to walk through it, right? This is in the heat. In the open, right?
The old days.
Steel,
yeah.
In the old days.
With fire hoses.
Crooks and crannies in the rocks, right? So one of the miracles in the Beit HaMikdash is that it didn't stink. And it didn't have flies. Those are miracles, and they're listed in Pirkei Avot. It's only in the first one. In the second one, it wasn't the case. But it didn't stink. Had it not, one way that didn't stink, besides the miracle, is that it did have a water system that came and cleaned it out. So as David HaMelech is digging down, he nicks whatever it is, and the water starts gushing forward and flooding the site, and he doesn't know what to do, and he's stymied. The Gemara has this story in it. And he says, quick, somebody tell me the halacha. Am I allowed to make a charm by putting God's name on a piece of clay and throw it into the water to get the waters to go down, to stop them? So Achitofel, sworn enemy, because you read Shmuel, of David HaMelech, says, yes, it's a kal v'chomer based on this, right? Based on this halacha. If you can destroy God's name to restore peace in the home, how much more so could you destroy God's name to maintain peace in the community or safety of those people around in the community? This could flood us all out. So yes, you can. So for that reason, David HaMelech, even though he tried to kill David, he had to call him Rebbe because he taught him a halacha.
Okay.
Anyway, so that we learned from here that you can, that, I mean, of course, we would be careful not to, but that God will allow his name to be destroyed for the sake of peace, and that that is a very important goal. Okay, so now, 366 and 367. So part of this whole process is her offering a mincha offering. So mincha offering is a grain offering, usually flour, and usually offered with oil, and perhaps frankincense, as we'll see in the next mitzvah. But for this mincha offering, this meal offering, you're not allowed to put flour, oil on it, and you're not allowed to put frankincense. So what's this? So it's a straight-up negative commandment. And he shall bring her offering, etc. He shall pour no oil on it.
So it's just the plain meal?
Yeah.
So it's really just
it can't be
barley.
Embellished.
Mm. Oil barley. Is light.
Correct. As to the root purposes of the precept, our sages of blessed memory said, it is in order that her offering should not have distinction, for oil is called light, and she acted in the dark. So she's still suspected. We don't know for sure, but she's treated as if she did it until it's... So she's... She's still suspected.
Proven innocent.
She's, right. In this case, because she already did enough, she's guilty until proven innocent in terms of the way she's treated, not in terms of the halacha. I mean, the halacha, the way she's treated, of course, Hashem will punish her or not punish her according to what she actually did. But she, for instance, cannot have sex with her husband during this entire time because it's as if she is guilty of it. So that's not permitted. So oil is called light. She acted in the dark. She committed the deed of an animal that allows all to mate with it. Therefore, her mincha offering is an inferior, debased one, being of barley, not of wheat. Barley is animal feed. Mm-hmm. So she brings a grain offering, but she brings the lowest grain offering. Right? So she brings the barley. When's the other time that we bring a barley offering?
Simchas Torah. No.
Barley. Where we go from animals to refined human beings. We start at a beginning of a cycle with a barley offering, and we end it with bread offerings. So not only is it a wheat offering, but it's a white bread offering, refined and processed, made into bread. So we go from barley, it's the omer. We offer the omer offering, which just shows we start out with just pretty base, and we go up levels of refinement until it's white bread that we're offering. Yeah, you did know that. That's why I didn't let you guess for too long. But you did know that. So this is the other animal offering because she did something that's animal-like, that she just was engaging in sex for the fun of it rather than for the connection of it, for the building of it. It's supposed to be fun, too, in marriage, but it's supposed to be about building and connecting, not just like animals do. right, so she can't have the oil on it because oil is the light. She did it in the dark, but also because oil floats. So I like this. For oil is above all other liquids since it floats above them all. But she, and it doesn't mix in either. Her sin was that she did mix in and that she wasn't above it. Right, so oil represents all those three things, the light and the floating and the not mixing. And that's what she did. So I think it's interesting to think about this just Erev Chanukah, as we are now, just thinking about the symbolism of oil being the light, and it's a miracle of the oil being us not mixing in, right? And being above, not above in a looking down kind of a way, but that we are meant to float above the population to be a role model and an example. So we have responsibility in our floating above, but we do we were supposed to be a vof, we're supposed to not mix in, we're supposed to be a light. That's our job, is to be like the oil. Okay, and let's see, is that where it says here? I want to look, where does it say about Sarah, you may know. Yeah, so that's in 367. That's interesting. So 367 is also not to put frankincense, which in Hebrew is called lavona. Don't put lavona in with the offering. Why not? It smells delicious. So it adds distinction to the offering. And so it's not suitable for a sinful woman to adorn her offering. So, and here's something interesting. Moreover, our sages of blessed memory said that the worthy and modest matriarchs are called symbolically frankincense, as it is stated into the hill of frankincense in the Song of Songs, and she departed from their ways. So how does that fit in here? It's interesting to think about. Like, why put, clearly she was wrong. We see that in the entire first mitzvah about doing the whole ceremony of the sota. Clearly she mixed in and behaved in dark and not in light. We see that in the second one of not putting the oil in. And you could just say you're not allowed to adorn it with the lovely smell of frankincense and leave it that. Why is the Chinuch putting this in, that our matriarchs were compared to frankincense and she departed from their ways?
Because they were
virtuous.
The virtuous.
Right, but she's so low. How do you go comparing her? An adulterous woman.
Well, also, didn't they adorn themselves during the time of the bondage in Egypt so that their husbands would...
Yeah, but that we're, this is talking about our matriarchs. This is about Sarah and Rivka and Rachel and Leah.
But also, I heard another very interesting thing about this whole concept of frankincense in regards to last week's parsha about Jacob and being thrown into the pit and being picked up by the Ishmaelites who traditionally...
Joseph.
Joseph, what did I say? Uh-huh.
Jacob, whatever.
Jay.
Yeah.
The Israelites traditionally carried petroleum products, mm-hmm. oil and tar and really smelly things. And when Joseph got onto this caravan, the first thing he smelled was frankincense, because Hashem changed all the oil products to beautiful spices and fragrances so that Joseph knew that he was not alone, that he was going down into Egypt, but Hashem was with him. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I love that. Mm-hmm. And the sense of smell is so important.
Very important. Yeah. It really is. Yeah, it's a fascinating mm-hmm. thing. So here, what I learned about this from Rabbi Rosner is that the reason why it puts in here the matriarchs is to teach us that no matter how low we go, we could always choose to be on their level. We could choose to turn around. A Jew is never far from the level of the matriarchs and the patriarchs. They should always be asking themselves, when will my deeds reach the level of my foreparents? Right? Whatever gender you are. So when will my deeds reach their level? And even if somebody's really strayed, they should still turn around and look at their role models and say, I could get there. Just because I sank low doesn't mean I can't be there. So instead of just saying she strayed from the practice of Jewish women, she strayed from the paradigmatic practice of Jewish women, like the pinnacle of what a Jewish woman could be as those matriarchs, and from that she departed. So it's just reminding us that though there's that distance, that's what we're aiming for, and that's what a Jew could be. So turn towards that and become that. They're called frankincense. You don't put frankincense on because you strayed from that. But return to that. That's where you're headed. Don't return to normal. Return to extraordinary.
If you can't put the oil on it and you can't put the frankincense on it and it just seems like such a lowly offering, why do you even bring it?
Oh, good question. Because it's not an offering. It's a korban.
It's a sacrifice.
It's not a sacrifice.
No. Sacrifice
it's a korban. A korban is a close maker.
Closer.
Right, so
thank you to bring
is that in your dictionary.
I think it might be. Oh, right, good. Thank you. You're
yes.
so nice.
Oh, the dictionary.
Thank you.
You're so nice.
Thank you.
Wow. Now I'm gonna look.
Yeah, look it up and see if it's there. Korban means close maker, and you have to understand it philosophically. That it is a
thank you so much.
A procedure through which one either strengthens or restores one's relationship to God. So it's not a sacrifice.
There's
not,
papers.
It's not about you sacrificing, and it's not about you offering God anything. It's about you doing something physical that causes something. Wow!
Well,
thank you so much.
Wow!
This is awesome.
Now I need another.
Yeah. I should have brought more clips. I didn't know you compiled this.
Yeah, it's not done. You'll see.
Wow.
And I will take any.
Fabulous.
It's a mess. This is just the beginning. I tried to make something like that. The whole thing's not in a chart.
Are you going to publish this?
Someday, if I ever finish it.
Korban, offering in the temple. Oh, literally, close maker, often and inadequately translated as sacrifice.
Oh, really?
I like that you stick to your guns.
So I would love to hear any feedback that you have on this, any words that I forgot or that you found. And I tried to put it in different ways so that you don't have to know how to spell correctly to look it up. So like, or you don't have to know that it's the same word. Like, olam sounds different than oilam if you don't know that that's the same word pronounced by different traditions, right? So you can look up oilam, oy, and olam, ol. And, you know, you'll get the same translation. But and then there's a what to say when chart in the back, which is not fully filled out either. And a few other things. But and then I tried to do some inventive words, and I want to look, there's what to do still in this.
Nice. This is amazing.
But it's a start.
You did this in your spare time, huh?
I know.
Yes,
I
call
up.
Thank you for copying.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll have these extra two copies.
Great, that's so nice,
The young lady with the pretty curly hair.
Oh, yeah, for Yana.
Yeah,
Yana and Miriam.
Miriam. Okay.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's
so nice of you.
Wow, that's such a gift.
It is a gift.
This is real.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so it's, again, still.
Maven.
Yeah.
Now you're a Egyptian.